This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Nice to see you guys.
Good to see you.
I'm going to start right off with a negative thing, and that'll be the last negative thing.
She's doing it.
Okay, it's not negative. It's just a question. I was in El Paso, Texas in the airport, and I had a chance to speak with I guess, 8 young women who were going over there, and they weren't going to a desk. They were going to the front lines. I just wondered, and they're from Texas. I just wondering why there weren't any women in your units and the whole thing.
It's a great, great question. I was interviewing soldiers across the country, and I was looking for the emblematic story of what was going on with this generation, which was fundamentally people either who were in the service or who had signed up for patriotic reasons. They wanted to protect their family, their country, their home. They went over there. The most profound realization that they had and that they shared with me was that once you get over there, it's not about why you signed up. It's about survival. It's about protecting the soldier to your left and the soldier to your right. The whole focus is to bring them home alive. Okay? So I want to tell that story. As I got into it, and I said, well, great, let's put a woman in here. But when I would go deeper into interviewing Army guys, not National Guard,
Okay.
So, and I wanted it to be Army. That was very important because there is a difference between the two, and I thought that again, was more emblematic. Even though I think that there's a great story in the National Guard, women are not put into combat in the Army.
Okay, these must have been Guard ladies.
Right.
Okay.
And the thing is this, that means that if you want that mentality of, I'm going to pick up a gun and I'm going to charge into this situation, I couldn't do it with a woman, right? But women are certainly doing combat. And this is very interesting. I went to Paris, Illinois, the homecoming of 1,000 soldiers of the 1544th Guard Unit, because I am very interested in the Guard. And those women, unfortunately, that unit had the highest casualty rate and the highest number of combat hours. So then you say, well, how are women getting killed in combat if women aren't supposed to be in combat? And that's because it was a transportation unit. So they were driving the generals to and from Abu Ghraib, and those kids were getting fired on the way. So women are fighting, right? But it's ending up that they're fighting because they're driving a car that gets attacked, which is just as valid as what the men are doing. But if I want to tell the story of this band of brothers,
then it's got to be about a brother.
Then it had to be about the men. And the men said to me, look, if we have a woman in our unit, it's not the same. We're not going to rely on her the same way. Now, is that right? Probably not. But that's what most men will confide to you. They're just like, it's about the camaraderie between men. And that's an issue that we need to deal with. But what I didn't want to do was diffuse the power and the authenticity of my male movie with something like that.
Okay, next.
How deep were you into the documentary? Because you started out, you wanted to make this as a documentary. How far were you into that when it dawned on you, or you had this idea of making it into a feature theatrical film?
It's a good question. I mean, when I say I was making a documentary, it was that I was doing what I do when I work, is I pick up a camera and I go, and I am drawn to something that's both personal. My brother was enlisted, and, you know, my country was at war, and I had been in New York for 9/11. I saw the towers fall. So there's something personal here. There's something I have a sense of, but there's something I don't fully understand. So for me to go and interview people, I can begin to get inside the story better. I always videotape everything. Like, my house is just filled with them. I was thinking, well, this will probably be a documentary. I was also collecting soldier-made videos. The videos that they take their handheld cameras, they put them on the gun turret, they put them on the ground, they put them in the sandbag, you know, and they film their experience in combat or their experience in the barracks. And then they go back and they edit it on their little computers, and they put it to Toby Keith or patriotic music, courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, I'm an American Soldier. Like, I love those songs. And they bring you to tears when you watch them because they're so patriotic, you know, and the way the guys cut it together. And also the rock music, Drowning Pools, Let the Bodies Hit the Floor. So I was collecting all this stuff, and I was trying to figure out, because I always let the material speak to me, what is the story here? And I was on the verge of making it into a documentary. I was about to buy all these cameras and send them to soldiers. What happens is I was paying for everything, and I get to a point where I'm like, if I know where this is going and I'm going to spend more of my own money, there's going to be a limit to what I can do. So I actually went to Participant Productions with a proposal. They were the ones who made the Al Gore documentary. And I actually, it was so funny, I talked to Davis Guggenheim, and he was like, I'm making this movie on global warming. And that's what he was working on. They were willing to give me money, and what happened was I said, you know what, I don't want to take, it would have been a substantial amount of money to move forward with the Soldier Made Video project, because I was starting to understand what the emblematic story of the generation was, and I didn't want to commit to an output of a documentary when I could tell that I was going to make a fiction. And the reason that making a fiction made more sense here is, so here I was listening to all these stories that were so moving. right, about soldiers' experiences in combat and coming home. No matter what, it was told in the past tense. So if I wanted to bring the audience as deeply as possible into the story, I was better off taking the stories that I was understanding, distilling them down into the underlying emotional truth, creating a fiction, and then I could tell it in the present tense.
And in so many areas of the country, there's still a reflexive tendency to reject anything that is deemed, you know, critical of the prosecution of the war. Do you feel that your film can overcome that? These people who are saying, don't speak ill of this war.
That is definitely an attitude that's out there. I've been very fortunate. This movie is pro-soldier. Mm-hmm. This movie was born from the soldiers' experiences, literally. My brother fought. I interviewed soldiers. We include their music videos, the videos that they make in the movie. We had soldiers, Iraq vets, and Marines from other wars look at every version of the script. They actually ran our boot camp. So Sergeant Major Jim Deaver, 25 years in the Marines, loves the military. I mean, this is his whole life. He's a total pro. He does all the Clint Eastwood's movies. He had trained many, many soldiers, and he set up a boot camp that was modeled after the training that he did for soldiers, for the actors. We had Iraq war vets in the boot camp because I wanted my boys, as they were being trained, I also wanted them to be talking to soldiers all the time. Find out from their perspective. What does it feel like? What does it feel like? And the great thing is we were all coming to the same conclusion. Every soldier says it's about camaraderie. So I didn't have to kind of dictate that. It was the reality was revealing itself. Soldiers have come to all the screenings. Soldiers are in most of the scenes when there's a lot of soldiers. And now I've just done this 22-city tour, and we go to a commercial theater, and we put people from colleges and people from the community and soldiers. Mm-hmm. We've had vets at every screening. And so often, I'll give you my website, you'll see, we've got soldiers standing up saying, thank you for making a movie that tells it accurately. I don't know how you did it, but you got it accurate. And thank you for respecting us, and thank you for protecting us.
Pro-soldier, but not necessarily pro-system.
Not necessarily. Yeah, you could put it that way. It's pro-soldier, right? And then this is the thing. When you tell a drama, which is really my passion, I love great stories, I love great characters, I love human issues, and I love issues that are personal to me. For me, it's always like about the character. Who is that person? How do they live? What would they say? What would they do? That's what I'm doing every single second of making the movie. So yeah, if the soldiers are having a problem with something, then the character can have a problem with it. Other than that, it really is out of my jurisdiction.
Can you talk a little bit about your casting?
Sure. I was really fortunate to have interviewed so many soldiers, so I had a real feeling of what these soldiers were like. And they were, more often than not, they were in great shape. They were strapping young men and women, and they were dedicated. They were people who volunteered, to serve their country. And I knew that I wanted to find a cast that really, really reflected that. I wanted soldiers to come to this movie and say, like they're saying, you got it right. There was no way I wanted soldiers to say, this is not authentic. So I went around and we actually cast the movie. I was very fortunate. A.V. Kaufman is one of the best casting directors. Scott Rudin's very smart about casting. And I actually auditioned everybody. So Ryan came in and he was fantastic. First of all, he felt like one of those guys. That was like off the bat what you needed. Deep voice, he's a handsome guy. He's strong, but also he has a maturity, probably because he's got two kids and he loves his kids and he is raising them. But he also has a sensitivity and an intelligence. And that was important for King, because King not only had to be the guy who's willing to die for his men, he had to be a great leader. He had to be smart enough to be able to win the guy's respect. And actually, we made Ryan, he had to lead part of the boot camp. He had to lead the missions, because I was like, you can't act like a leader. You have to actually be the leader of the guys. People are going to feel that in the movie. Channing Tatum, he's gorgeous, hunky. He's charismatic. He's the guy. I mean, he's the hot-headed guy who's probably going to do the thing that's going to, going to challenge you if you're the leader. His mother gave me a bunch of pictures of him as a kid, because you have to create, little portraits of the boys. You need Steve Shriver's, pictures. He's like, football star, and he's like, acrobatic. And his mother told me that she called him Chanimal. And it was funny because I found that out after I had called him Manimal. Because I was like, you're my man animal. And, we've Channing would just routinely pick me up and just put me on top of his head. I mean, yeah, that was real, real safe. But he's just, you know, he's lovely, and he's. He came into the audition, and people hadn't really seen his movies. So for me, you know, when I see an actor who's brilliant and who's right, I know that there's going to have to be a little bit of, like, you know, rolling up your sleeves. So he came in three times. And on the third audition, which was in New York, we started out in L.A., I said to him, look, you know, it's going to be a little bit of a push, but if you are willing to work with me for a few hours and I can make a tape, I can convince them. And he said, I will do anything for this role, anything. And so we worked and worked and worked. And we really tapped into, you know, his talent and sent the tape to Scott Rudin. And I was like, Scott, this guy's great. I mean, I know it's going to be tough to cast him. Scott loved it. And we both called the studio, and maybe Scott's call mattered more. I don't know. But it was great. You know, Scott just said, do the right thing. This kid's great, you know. And, again, I have to thank the studio. It's like they, I mean, this, for an artist, this is so important for me that I can use whatever talent or awareness I have to find these actors, but then, you know, they have to give me the money to make the movie, and they have to believe that we can somehow make it back. So when they take a risk like that, that's amazing. Joe Gordon-Levitt, I think one of the best actors of his generation. He's so astute. He's so on point. He's so emotionally connected. He doesn't give you a false move. He is just a pleasure to work with. So that was the casting of the boys. I love Victor, you know. I know he's not in the movie as much as the other boys, but, man, he's for me, he's so raw, he's so honest. He's got that charm and that lightness, which was so necessary. I interviewed a bunch of, obviously, I was interviewing many soldiers, but particularly the wounded soldiers. Mm-hmm. And there were ones that just, you know, whether they were holding on to that spirit because that's what made their life bearable, or they naturally had that spirit, but there was a kind of optimism that we had to capture. And Abby Cornish is just, she's a wonderful actress, and I think we're going to see so much from her to come. She was my first choice. She was unavailable. And you're like, no, that's not possible. Can we delay the movie? I mean, I can't. No, we can't. No, we can't, right? So I'm looking at all these girls, and they're very talented, but they're not right. And I'm like, can you make it work? Can you make it work? So I'm delaying. I'm like looking, and then her agent calls up and says, Abby read your script. She loves it. She wants to be in your movie. And I was like, oh, my God, how does this call happen? And then they're like, and she wants to audition, which I didn't say to them, she doesn't have to audition. I would hire her anyway because I've seen Candy and Somersault, and she's amazing. She flew from Australia all the way to Texas, and we did an old-fashioned screen test. And what a joy. So I love my cast.
Why 9 years in films?
I think it's going to be 8 when this comes out. First of all, Boys Don't Cry was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I fell in love with that character, that story. I was in grad school when I made it. It was a huge joy and kind of a surprise when I came out of grad school and I had this wonderful Hollywood career. And, you know, for me it's about emotional truth. It's about stories that I love. So I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I started working on another story. I won't bore you with the details. It's a story that will eventually get made, the William Desmond Taylor murder. I got it. Exactly. Great story. So I mean, if you knew the research I did, I went to the King Vidor collection. I got everything that had ever been written on it. We solved the murder mystery. We figured out who did it, how they did it, and how and why it had to be covered up. So it was an amazing experience. Hollywood basically covered up this murder along with the government to protect the industry. It was about to be erased and to protect America's innocence.
How useful was Vidor's book?
Very useful. Well, I read Vidor's scripts too. But I'll tell you what was interesting was that Vidor came to a conclusion about the murder in order to protect somebody. So we had to read between the lines on Vidor's research. So I went back to his estate and I got all the... A number of documents had been stolen. But anyway, we'll talk about that in the next press conference when I make that movie. So I cast that movie. Annette Bening, Hugh Jackman, Ben Kingsley, Evan Rachel Wood, dream cast. Studio's like, we love this movie. I was on the one-yard line. We were going to shoot and they said, we would love to see the $30 million version of this movie. We would like to pay for the $20 million version. I was like, should I cut $10 million? Mm-hmm. They were like, no, we want to see the $30 million version. We want to pay for the $20 million version. And this is the thing that people should understand about directors' careers. Unfortunately, if you want to do stuff that you really believe in and that you really love, it can take longer than you would like it to take. I was offered millions of dollars, and I was offered a number of projects. As I would go down the road with them, for me, it really is about telling stories that I love and that are meaningful to me. So I couldn't just pick up a script and do it if I didn't believe in it, because every day of my life is living and breathing the movie. And it really is. Every decision I make has to do with character. It has to do with story. And as long as those characters and those stories are something that I know are solid, that the story comes from the characters, you can throw me in any situation. You can say to me, you need to cut that in half. You need to get rid of that scene. You need to do this. I do what I do because it's based on character. So when Hollywood's offering me these movies, which I appreciate, if they're not coming from rich characters, it's not worth it to me. So I lost some time with the William Desmond Taylor story. But, you know, I think you never really lose time with art. What ends up happening is I learned a tremendous amount. Literally the next week, I mean, that was the end of 03. I picked up my video camera and I started interviewing soldiers. And I paid for all the research and I paid for writing the script. So I wrote it on spec, which a person in my situation who can get lots of money to work in Hollywood, it's really unusual. But by keeping it on, and I was like friends with a lot of studio heads who would say, oh my God, these stories about the war are amazing. Do you want us to develop it with you? And I was like, you know what? Let me just develop it on my own, because right now I wake up and I buy a cheap ticket and I go to Paris, Illinois, and I interview the homecoming of 1,000 soldiers, and I don't have to call somebody and say, oh my God, this is interesting. I just have to say, oh my God, it's interesting. Let me book the ticket. So then on a Friday, we gave the financiers and the studios, we gave them the finished, a screenplay that we were willing to shoot. You always are working on the screenplay. And then we cut together the soldier-made videos and images from all over America that I had interviewed soldiers, gave it to the studios with the rock music, and they saw that it was going to be a young, hunky cast. You know, it was inherently commercial. And gave it to them on a Friday. By Sunday morning, we had four studios and two financiers that wanted to not only buy the screenplay, because I didn't want to sell the screenplay, I wanted to make the movie. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And the deal was, you buy it, you make it. So.
Cool. Way to go.
Ryan was actually saying earlier, I don't know, maybe he was joking, but he said when you first spoke with him that you didn't think he was right for the role, that he had to kind of prove to you that he could do it.
That's what an actor does in an audition.
Okay.
Good answer.
All right.
So I'll ask, are you working, are you going to go back to that project, or are you taking a break, or what's...
No, I'm definitely not taking a break. I'm having too much fun working. I love making movies. I will go back to that project. It's a really valuable lesson that I learned, because I do personal, intense, emotional stories, and it's all about character. They can be wildly commercial. They can be huge audiences, but the timing has to be right. So I have to see if the timing is right, I will make that movie. And if the timing is not right, that just means if the world wants it to be made. If not, then I will do another one of the scripts that I'm working on. So I'm working on two scripts right now. One is a romantic comedy, which I know everybody's totally shocked by that, but it's actually a very funny story that's true. It's a gender twist on a classic romantic comedy. And I'm writing another kind of dark sexual story. And again, it's like I just have to kind of see if they're ready to go, because you can just feel it. The culture just makes it when they are. And I'm also reading scripts, you know, I'm actually kind of focusing on a political thriller that's realistic, that's fantastic, that's coming out of the studio. So,
a Canadian
one last question,
question,
please.
A Canadian question.
Oh, good.
Did your researchers actually tell you that it's possible to get a good-looking Canadian passport for $1,000?
Yeah. Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the good-looking part. You know, that's all based on real interviews. There are people who actually help soldiers go over the border. And what's really interesting is during Vietnam, American soldiers could go to the border, well, anybody, and you could actually get a passport at the border. So if you were on the run, you could get a passport at the border. So I think 50, 60,000 American soldiers went over. And, you know, the laws have changed. So now, if you're AWOL... Well, now, to get a citizenship in Canada, you have to apply from the country that you're coming from. Well, these guys can't do that. And you have to wait 2 years. So now we have between 200 and 300 American soldiers up there, because I interviewed Josh Key, Jeremy Hinsman, Brandon Huey. You can just Google it. Michelle Rubidoux. And it's amazing. They're over there, and they can't get citizenship, right? Because that would...
They're fighting extradition.
Exactly. They can't get citizenship. That's been rejected. And they can't get even refugee status. That's been rejected. And the parliament in April is going to be determining whether they let them stay or not, whether they deport them. So it's a very interesting issue how linked Canada and America are.
What if they go to Mexico? That's a whole other...
Yeah, but it's a minority parliament. The liberals and the socialists have the majority.
Right. So going to Mexico, Yeah, you can go to Mexico, but most Americans probably, I don't want to speak for them, but they're probably going to find the life in Canada more reflective of, like, the life they're in America.
Yeah.
So then Mexico, which, you know, I mean, I think, yeah. So I love Mexico, but...
So if these guys get they get deported...
Thank you!
Awesome. Yeah, I like the jacket.
If they get deported, do they go to military prison then?
When I understand it's Iraq or jail. But by the time you cross the border and then come back, the only option may be Iraq. We don't know because nobody has been deported. We haven't. Mm-hmm. So look in April and May, and you'll get the answer to that. But it's fascinating reading if you if you look up on it. And I'm, you know, I know a lot of those people, so it's
great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cool.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Absolute pleasure. Oh, I know. Here, really quickly. I have a website.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Cool. And. www.stoplossmovie.com/soundoff We gave cameras to soldiers and their families, and they there they are, and they tell their stories, which is, you know, what I love, and they post it, and then soldiers, their families, people write in about my screenings and about that, and it's really, it's a big community.
Great.